The industry has grown a great deal over the last 20 years, and it has become much more of a mainstream investment. When you look at who's buying and selling commercial real estate, it's not just big institutions and funds. In fact, private investors are about 60% of the market, and that includes syndicators.
Welcome to Passive Income Pilots, where pilots upgrade their money. This is the definitive source for personal finance and investment tactics for aviators. We interview world-renowned experts and share these lessons with the flying community. So if you're ready for practical knowledge and insights, let's roll.
Welcome back to Passive Income Pilots, everyone. I'm your host, Tate Duryea. I'm here with my co-host, Ryan Gibson, and we have just the best guest today, Jonathan Chang. Ryan, how you doing, man?
Oh, we're doing great. Hi, Jonathan. Thanks for joining us today. Love your presentations, and I'm super stoked. The Fed met yesterday. Wasn't stoked about the interest rate hike, but
it was expected.
I'm stoked about you actually debriefing us, like in real time, like giving us like right to the minute information. John's got an awesome presentation. He's going to walk us through, and we're also live on Facebook for the first time. So,
yes.
If you're tuning
hopefully
in,
it's working.
And yeah, hopefully it's working. We'll check my notifications here. But John, give us like a 15-second who you are before we start the presentation. We'll kind of just warm up here as people are joining the live feed.
Sure, absolutely. So I'm John Chang, and I run research services for Marcus & Millichap, which is a commercial real estate brokerage company. Marcus & Millichap helps investors buy and sell properties as well as finance them, and we do more transactions than any other company out there. I run our research services team. Basically, we're looking at the economics, the demographics, and all the major trends for all the different property types to offer investors insights on where we think the market where we think the market's going and how investors can capitalize on that. We make a ton of research available on our website, and we're on LinkedIn so that people can access this. We don't charge for our research. We do it as a service to investors across the entire industry. So we're happy to help investors make better informed decisions.
Yeah, and well, actually, Marcus Millichap, we bought a property through Marcus & Millichap, the Tower Longview portfolio. This is back in 2020. Really great deal. And M&M just sold two properties for us in Colorado. And one closes on Monday. So, yeah.
And might I add that John Chang does the keynote presentation that opens nearly every real estate conference in the United States. And it is 80 to 90% of the reason that I go to these conferences is to see you speak. So I'm so honored to have you on the show today. Thank you.
I'm happy to be here. Thank you, gentlemen.
Yeah. Well, you have a slide deck. This is the first time that we've had someone on that has a slide deck. So if you're listening to this on the podcast, go to our YouTube channel and check this out, because John has an entire presentation here that's incredible, following the day after the Fed chair meeting on July 26th. This is recording on July 27th. John, we'll turn it over to you.
Well, thank you. So it is an extensive slide deck. There's a lot of data and information in here. I'm going to talk a little bit about why people should be investing in commercial real estate, why, what's happening with the economy, what's driving opportunities from a demographic standpoint. And then we'll drill down into eight different property types. And I'll talk a little bit about each of them, as well as what's happening in the transaction market and some of the opportunities we see ahead in the second half of this year, as well as into 2024. So I got a lot of information. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on any one piece of this, but I wanted to give everybody a good macro perspective that drills down to some more localized information as we go through. And so I want to start with, why should people be investing in commercial real estate? And, so much of Americans' investments are going into the stock market. If you look back, if you had put $1 million into commercial real estate in 2000, or put that money into the stock market. If you look at your compounded returns on those investments, the commercial real estate portfolio today, that $1 million would be worth about $5.5 million, whereas the stock portfolio would be about $4 million. Based on the S&P 500. So a lot of people don't realize that when you look at a long-term trend in commercial real estate relative to other investment classes, it can do very well. In fact, it outperforms the stock market and it's much less volatile. Now, if you had put money in the stock market in 2020 or real estate, you know, certainly that big surge in the stock market values over the last couple of years has done well for you. But when you look at a long-term basis, which most investors are typically doing, the real estate is outperforming. When you look at the yields for different types of real estate, as well as different investments, you can see that cap rates are running anywhere between about 5.5% and 8%, depending on the property type and location. And if you compare that, say, to the 6-month treasury, that's at about 5.5% right now. And the 10-year treasury is at about 4%. So overall, you're getting a little bit of a yield premium. The market has changed a lot in the last 6-9 months. So there's a lot of variance to this. And these are estimates on current yields for commercial real estate because the market is moving so quickly. One of the other things I like to point out is just how much the transactions have grown over the last 20 something years. When you look at the transaction basis, it's been on a steady rise all the way from, you know, 2001, it was, you know, in the, you know, 8,000 to 10,000 transactions per year. And now we're up in the 40,000 to 50,000 transactions per year. That's $2.5 million and greater. If you extend that threshold down to $1 million, the actual transaction count is pushing in the 70,000 range. So there's a lot of transactions that are taking place today. The industry has grown a great deal over the last 20 years, and it has become much more of a mainstream investment. When you look at who's buying and selling commercial real estate, it's not just you know, big institutions and funds. In fact, private investors are about 60% of the market, and that includes syndicators. But when you look at how much capital is being targeted into commercial real estate by the institutions, the life insurance companies, and the major institutional investors, the allocation being put into commercial real estate has been growing steadily over the last 10 years, and now is about over 11% of the institutional portfolios. So we've seen a big increase in how much capital institutions are pushing into commercial real estate, and that's part of what's driving this rising capital into the space. But private investors are still the most active component of the market. As I mentioned at the beginning, we're going to talk about 8 different property types as part of this conversation. I'm not going to do a deep dive into any one of them. Really, I just wanted to kind of touch on some of the pros and cons of each, as well as what we're seeing in the market today for each of these types of properties. We're going to talk about apartments, office buildings, medical office buildings, multi-tenant retail, single-tenant retail, industrial, and of course, self-storage, as well as hotels. So I'm going to tap into some of these areas. But before I go there, I want to talk about one of the biggest drivers of commercial real estate demand that we track, and that is demographics. When you look at that center pie chart, the share of population, you can see that there's the boomers and the millennials, right? They're 27 and 28% of the population of the U.S. Gen X is a little smaller, 25%, and the other generations are also smaller. But what I've put out here in these other ring charts is the share of self-storage users, for example, who are within each of these demographic cohorts. And you can see that millennials over-index for self-storage in the top left. They over-index for rental occupancy in the top right. They over-index in consumption expenditures in the bottom left. But on the other hand, you see that baby boomers, over-indexed for healthcare visits, which would affect medical office and seniors housing, as well as travel spending, which affects the hotel market and some of the retail sectors. So when we look at different property types, these are some of the factors we're really looking into. And you can see here on this next graph how many people are at each age group and some of the life milestones we monitor. Marriage at the age of 29 is a very significant factor in driving household formation as well as spending. First home home purchase, now 36 years old, is another major milestone for households, and it drives a lot of the behavior when it comes to commercial real estate. And then you look over there at the baby boomers and that huge wall of aging population pushing into their 70s, mid-70s, and what that means for, say, medical office and seniors housing demand going into the future. A lot of investors are banking on that wave to drive their investment decisions. So this is one of the most important things that I'm looking at when I'm comparing different property types and different markets and behavior. And when you look at where people are moving, especially the millennial generation, they're going into the Sun Belt, the Southeast, Florida, Texas, the Southwest, as well as Salt Lake City and Denver are the major beneficiaries of the population growth. That is another significant trend that we're monitoring to derive our demand driver forecast. So you can see how that's played out in the Northeast, the upper Midwest. Have a much lower pace of growth. Even they could even be losing population over the next 5 years. And so we need to factor that into how we model our forecasting on the performance of different commercial real estate assets and where we think they're going to be going. But remember, demand is only part of the equation. The other thing you have to factor in is supply. And I'll talk a little bit about that, the construction pipeline as part of the conversation when I drill down into some of the property types. So now I'm going to talk a little bit about the economy, because all commercial real estate is operating within the broader context of the economy. What's happening with jobs? What's happening with consumption? What's happening with inflation? What the Fed's doing? All of those are key drivers of commercial real estate. And so we definitely want to keep track of these macro drivers, as well as what's happening on a more localized basis and in the commercial real estate space. So the biggest question over the last 9 months has been, are we going into a recession, right? We had inflation, we had the Fed response to the inflation, and the big question was, are we going into a recession? And when you look at some of the indicators, the yield curve is one of the most notable. You'll see this in the news all the time. The yield curve has inverted, and it inverted last October. And it's been inverted ever since. In fact, that inversion has been really significant. We normally don't see it invert as much as it has. And historically, the yield curve has been a pretty good indicator of an impending recession. It's about 80% correct. We've had a couple of false positives where there have been inversions and there was no recession. Although we did tread very close to recession, we didn't actually go into one. The ISM manufacturing index, basically the manufacturer's perception of their future sales and where they think it's going. If it's under 50, that means manufacturing is in contraction. That usually happens in a recession. Right now, it is at a 46. Consumer credit and use of credit typically goes up when we're in a recession. We see an upward trend there. And small business optimism is usually down when we're in a recession. And small business optimism is actually pretty low right now. It's at a reading of about 91. And that's historically been a recessionary level of optimism for small businesses. So we have all these indicators saying, hey, we should be going into a recession. But on the other side, there are other measurements. For example, unemployment. Almost every time we've had a recession, the unemployment rate has gone up by 50 basis points for three consecutive months. That means in order to signal a recession is coming, unemployment should be about 4%, not 3.5%. And we haven't seen that number budge in the last year. So unemployment rate is actually just as good of an indicator as the yield curve, but it is not showing that movement. And so that's one thing that's saying, hey, there's no recession coming. The non-manufacturing index, basically the services index, is above 50. Manufacturing was at 46. Non-manufacturing services is at 54. It's saying, hey, there's no recession coming. When you look at job creation, we lose jobs when we have a recession, and we're not losing jobs. We're continuing to add jobs every month for the last couple of years. So we still see momentum there. And consumer confidence has recently bounced. We're seeing upward momentum on consumer confidence. That's above 100. So that's in a positive territory as well. So we have conflicting indicators telling us different things. If you look back to October of last year, basically every economist was saying we're going to have a recession in 2023. If you look at the blue chip economic forecast, which basically takes all the top economists in the country and boils it down to a number, last October, they were forecasting that GDP growth for 2023 would be 0.2%. It was very, very low. And basically, everybody was saying, hey, we're going to have a recession in the second half of 2023. Then if you look at what their readings were in January, it had inched up. It was at basically 0.5% growth. Then if you look at their forecast in May, it was up to 1.1%. And in June or July, it was now up to 1.5% or 1.6% expectations for 2023. We had just got a reading in this morning that the growth rate of GDP for the second quarter was 2.4%. The first quarter was revised to 2%. And basically, everybody's saying, nope, no recession this year. Maybe next year, but not this year. So the economic outlook has continued to strengthen over the last 9 months, and that momentum is carrying through. Everybody's talking about the Federal Reserve achieving a soft landing, which really pretty much hasn't ever been done before. So it's looking very positive for the remainder of the year in terms of the economy. Let's see. My clicker stopped working. So as we go forward, when we look at what's happening with employment, I have to point out, we have 3.1 million more jobs today than we ever have in the history of the country. Basically, jobs are looking better than they ever had. We're averaging about 300,000 jobs per month this year, and that is down. It's definitely softening, and actually the Fed likes that it's softening, and we have that momentum there. It is definitely slowing down. But the fact is we have more jobs today than we ever had. The unemployment rate's 3.6%. And when you look at the number of job openings, it is still well above where we were, where we have our labor supply. Basically, we have a 4 million person labor shortage out there, and that's going to keep that unemployment rate very tight as we go forward. Basically, if the Fed were trying to generate a surge in unemployment, they would have to burn through most of those existing job openings to get to the point where they're starting to create a loss of jobs. We just don't expect that to happen, not this year, not next year. The momentum is certainly there to carry positive employment growth forward. And employment growth is absolutely essential to the demand for commercial real estate. So that's one of the key metrics we're monitoring and tracking, and the outlook for job creation remains quite strong. When you look at what's happening with core retail sales on an inflation adjusted basis, right? You have to track that inflation adjusted metric. Basically, we had a huge surge in core retail sales as we were going through the pandemic. We got all that stimulus in the economy. People's savings shot through the roof. We saw this huge wave of consumption. And then retail sales started to slow down a little bit. And over the last year, retail sales have basically flattened out on an adjusted inflation adjusted basis. And part of that is savings. We've been tracking what people have in terms of savings, in terms of their money market funds. And we've seen that they had a huge level of growth in the savings. Basically, over the course of the pandemic, $5 trillion of extra savings was put into the banks. That was part of what was driving inflation. People had money in their pockets and they needed somewhere to spend it. And our supply chains were broken. So basically, consumption had shot through the roof because people had lots of cash and the supply chains were weak. So the suppliers weren't able to keep up with it. That drove a lot of our inflation. But you can see this dashed line here. We mapped out the trajectory of savings based on the historical trend. And it looks like savings have been burned off to the point where we're back into alignment with where it should be. That implies to me that the purchasing is going to slow down. The consumption is going to slow down. That will drive down inflation and that will ease some of the pressure on the economy. If you look at some of the other metrics that are key indicators for inflation, you have wage growth, which is still at 4.5%. That's not coming down. That's that labor shortage I was talking about. And that's one of the things the Fed keeps talking about when you listen to them at their meetings. They keep saying, hey, wages are still elevated. They're 4.5%. That we want them to be at 2% and they're not coming back down. We're just going to have to fight through that. That's just one of those forces that is going to continue to drive inflation as we go forward. But when you look at things like the home prices, those have flattened out. The price of gas has flattened out. And the producer price index, which is the cost of goods used by manufacturers, are basically 0% inflation now. They peaked out at about 12% inflation last year in March. Now they're basically zero. That is a forward indicator of what we can expect from inflation going forward. That is a key driver, and we expect that to be one of the forces that helps us bring the inflation rate down. So if you look at all the headline numbers, we keep hearing about the consumer price index, the CPI, that's down to 3%. Last year in June, that peaked at about 9.3%. When you look at the producer price index, the PPI, that's basically zero. It was at 12% a little over a year ago. But the Fed is looking at core PCE, core personal consumption expenditures. That new number actually comes out tomorrow. But it is a trailing indicator. It's a month behind the other indicators. And based on where we're seeing everything else going, I expect to see the core PCE to come down from 4.6 to somewhere around 4.3 when the new data comes out tomorrow. So hopefully that comes true. And in eyeballing it, we're in the right range. And that will help to restrain the Fed from raising rates as we go forward through the remainder of the year if they see that indicator coming down. Now, the Fed pushed interest rates a lot last year. They drove it up 300 basis points in like 140 days. That's less time than you have to do a 1031 exchange. So it really, really threw a wrench into the commercial real estate market. Buyers couldn't lock in their financing. They would put a deal under contract with financing at 4%. And by the time they got to the closing table, their cost of capital was 5.5%. And it caused mayhem in terms of the pricing and the ability to close transactions. It really opened up a disconnect between the buyers and sellers because the sellers are saying, hey, my building's worth $10 million. And the buyer says, yeah, it was. But now that my cost of capital's gone up by, 150 basis points, 200 basis points, it's not to me. Now it's only worth $9 million. And so we had this disconnect, and that really had an impact on the commercial real estate market, but it also had a huge effect on the banking system. So when you look at, last March, April, May, we had some banks shut down. There was this big news, Silicon Valley Bank, Signature Bank, First Republic Bank, all were shut down. And although they've been trotted out in front of Congress and everybody wants to slap their wrist, in reality, they were following traditional banking practices. They would get money. They would receive savings. They'd go into accounts. They'd go out and put it into long-term investments like real estate, like long-term bonds. But the thing was, is the interest rates moved so fast that they got upside down on their debt. And basically, as the Treasury rates went up so quickly, a lot of people pulled their money out of those banks and they went and invested into treasuries instead of leaving them in savings accounts. And these banks had particular vulnerability in that the people who had their money in the savings accounts had lots of money in the accounts. I was talking to one guy at the time the Silicon Valley Bank was going under. He was trying to pull $200 million out of that bank in one day. You know, he's on the phone on his app trying to withdraw $200 million to move it into a different account because it was because Silicon Valley Bank was in trouble. And that run on the bank is what killed those banks, right? They basically didn't have enough cash to cover all of those withdrawals because they were happening so fast, they couldn't keep up with it. So as a result, you look at the banks and what they did over the last 4 months. They have increased their bank reserves by $300 billion, by 10%, because they're afraid of those runs on the bank. They want to make sure they have plenty of cash on hand. Now, when you compare that to the global financial crisis in 2007, the bank reserves were at $44 billion, right? That's like minuscule compared to where we are today with $3.3 trillion in bank reserves. The banks are fundamentally sound. They're going to go through a rocky period as their investments are rolled over into the current interest rate climate. That's causing some problems. But the other side of it is they've reduced their lending, and that's impacting commercial real estate. So most banks have tightened their lending standards, and they continue to do that. 60% of the banks surveyed are tightening their lending. The loan to values have been dropped into the 50, 60% range on the assets when you can get a loan. So the banks are bolstering their balance sheets. They're preparing in case there's a run on the bank, and they're trying to be safe and secure. And as a byproduct of that, they're lending to commercial real estate much less than they had been, and they've tightened up their lending criteria. So now I'm going to dive into what's happening with the commercial real estate performance, where we see different property types. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on any one of these, but just some highlights here. The apartment sector has done very, very well over the last several years. It's been a top performing asset. It's generated a lot of wealth. The rents have been growing. The vacancies have been, actually, they hit a record low about a year and a half ago. Since then, they've bounced back. But a key piece of that is construction. The completions of apartment buildings as a percentage of the total inventory for this year will be 2% of the total inventory. So if there were no new renters, nobody moved out, nobody moved in, the vacancy rate would go up about 2%. And that's what we're seeing. Vacancies are up about 2% compared to a year ago. The cap rates are about 5.5%. So if you look at vacancy and completions are at record levels, 400,000 units coming online. We haven't seen this probably since the 80s when the baby boom generation was moving out and creating households. And now we have the millennial generation out there creating new households. That's driving that wave of growth. And we see that momentum there. Vacancies are on the rise as a byproduct of that, but also because people were so scared about a recession, they weren't moving out. So the demand for housing units last year fell pretty significantly. And this year it's reviving and coming back. We see positive absorption in the pipeline for the first and second quarter so far this year. And we expect it to continue to rise in the second half of the year. To put some of these vacancy rates in perspective, again, you got to be careful. You can't paint the entire picture with one brush. So you have a vacancy in some of the top growth markets, Atlanta, Houston, San Antonio. They have vacancies in the 7% range. And at the other end of the spectrum, you have New York with a vacancy of 1.8. Milwaukee, a market we don't normally see in the top rankings, has a vacancy rate of 3.1% in the second quarter. San Diego, another market, vacancy rate of 3.4%. A lot of that vacancy rise has been in the Class A space. B because of the new construction. Last year, we saw the urban vacancies rise, but they've come back down now. That was because of the migration patterns from the urban core to the suburbs. Now we're starting to see the suburban vacancy rise, and that's because the majority of the new units being completed are in the suburbs. When you look at where these units are coming in, Dallas is at the top of the list. 29,000 units expected to be completed in 2023 in Dallas. Phoenix, about 21,600 units, and New York, about 19,000. And just to put a little color on that, California, the entire state of California, is expected to add about 34,000 new units in 2023. And that's way up for them. So basically, you have a city like Dallas-Fort Worth producing almost as many new units as the state of California. And that's why California is always so supply constrained, and also why rents are so high in California is a byproduct of their construction policies rather than all these homeless issues that we hear about. Basically, you just don't have enough supply to keep up with demand in the state of California. So when you look at retail, shifting gears here, retail has really outperformed. The vacancy rate is basically back to pre-pandemic levels, 5.5%. And that is pretty much the lowest we've seen it in 20 years or more. Rents have been growing at about 3.5%, which is quite good. The cap rates are in the 7% range. Those are actually doing very strong. We didn't see as much movement on retail as we did in, say, multifamily or industrial, because the cap rates on multi-tenant retail were not as compressed as they have been for some of the other property types. That just hasn't been as strong a performing property type. But right now, it is one of the top performing asset classes. Single tenant retail also holding up very well. Vacancies very low, rent growth out there, cap rates in the 6.5%. A lot of the demand drivers for the single tenant are 1031 exchanges because they are minimal requirements for management, and it makes it easy for investors. It's basically, generally speaking, the leases are guaranteed by corporations, and so it's much more of a coupon clipper, if you will, with little to no management or maintenance, and that's supporting the single tenant sector. When you look at the total retail, this is blended single tenant plus multi-tenant. Vacancy rate right now is 4.6%. We expect that to rise a little bit, hit 5% this year. But historically speaking, going back to 2001, that's a very low vacancy rate. Almost no construction in the pipeline for retail still. Rent growth, 3.5%. We expect that to ease back to the 3% range over the course of the rest of this year. But again, still really good. Then there's office. Now, office is a bit of a challenge. Now, vacancy rate overall, 17%. That's a record high. Rent growth basically flat, cap rate 7.5%, and pretty much on the rise. So when you look at what's happening with office, you have a lot of this momentum there is driven by a work from home or hybrid working plans. And basically, nobody really knows what their office demand is going to be. People were renewing leases on a short-term basis as we were going through the pandemic, and they're starting to let those roll off. Vacancy rates are on the rise. But again, we have to be careful not to paint the whole picture with one brush. Absolutely, there are markets that face a very challenging time when it comes to their vacancy rates. San Francisco, 23.5% vacancy. Dallas, 21.5%. Chicago, 20.5%. But there are markets like Las Vegas, which are very tight. 12.4% vacancy in Vegas. Miami, 11.5%. Inland Empire, 9.1% vacancy. That's Riverside, San Bernardino area. It's still very, very tight. When you look at the urban vacancy, it's up to 18.7%, worse than what we're seeing in the suburbs, which have a vacancy of 16.3%. Class A office space, 22% vacancy compared to Class B and C at 13% vacancy. So there's a lot going on in the office space field, and it's really unique depending on that specific building in that specific location in that specific market. It's a tough market to invest in. Lending is basically not available on office right now. I was talking to a very significant office investor. They went to a bank. They only needed a $10 million loan on a $20 million building. I was 50% leverage. The bank said, great, we're happy to lend it to you, but you have to deposit $10 million in a savings account with our bank in order for us to give you that loan. And so it's really difficult to get lending. If you don't know the office market right now, is not the time to get in. If you do know the office market and you have a war chest of cash, there are some amazing opportunities out there right now. Some of these buildings are selling, you know, half off what they traded for the last time they were sold. So there are a lot of opportunities out there, but it is not for the faint of heart or for the beginner. It's definitely an area where you do need expertise and the capital to make it work. Now, medical office is a segment of the office sector, which is actually doing very well. Vacancy rate's about just over 9%, and that's about normal for medical office. But the cap rates are running between 7 and 8%, and you have these long-term leases. Typically, a medical office building will have a 12-year lease, and there, you know, you may have medical professionals there, doctors who are guaranteeing those leases. These properties, because of the baby boomers, those demographics I was talking about earlier, the demographics are really strong for medical office over the long term, and that's going to bolster the value of those assets that are well-maintained and sustained over that time. If you have a medical office building with a lot of heavy equipment, dialysis machines and MRI machines, those doctors tend not to move. So those can be pretty good bets right now. As we look forward, there's a lot of capital looking at these as long-term investments with steady income and some appreciation potential to boot as you go forward and as the baby boomers age. Industrial property type has been pretty much one of the hottest properties out there, outperformed, hit a record low vacancy rate last year. Now that's bouncing back again because of construction. 400 million square feet in the pipeline for completion in 2023. That's 2.3% inventory growth. And those cap rates, the average cap rate for industrial is a little bit hard to pin down. It is the average at 6.5%, but the range on cap rates for industrial are anywhere between about 5% and 10%, depending on the type of building, the location of the building, and so on. There's a huge variance in those cap rates for industrial space, but in a nutshell, they have been a top contender for capital over the last few years. Again, you know, you look at vacancy rates, they've trickled up where it's just coming off a record low. But vacancy rates in Austin at over 8%, San Francisco 7%, Dallas 6.9%. And then at the other end of the spectrum, you have like a Las Vegas with a 2.8% vacancy, Orange County 2.5%, and Miami with a 1.9% industrial vacancy rate right now. So Miami definitely outperforming. You look at completions, like I said, 400 million square feet coming online this year, 44 million, over 10% of that is in Dallas. Chicago, 26 million square feet. Houston and Atlanta each have 25 million square feet coming online, and Phoenix has about 20 million square feet. So this is very concentrated. About 80% of the construction is in about 10 cities. So there is a huge portion of this that's going into these big box industrial spaces in some intermodal hubs and transportation hubs. If you look at, you know, in-city last mile logistics hubs, a logistics space, those can be very low vacancy rates and have a long-term sustainability, very little construction happening in the inner city. So again, huge range on what's happening with industrial, but still one of the most favorite assets out there. Storage has a very interesting story to tell, and it's really done very well through the course of the pandemic. It did have what I would call an asynchronous risk. Basically, when other properties were getting impacted worse, self-storage does better, and vice versa. So what we've seen is, we've had a huge wave of construction in 2017, 18, 19, 20. This huge wave of construction hit. And quite frankly, the vacancy rate forecasts for 2020 were somewhere in the 12% range. And that's kind of, you know, traditionally kind of the normal range. But then we had the pandemic. People returned from college, put their stuff in storage. People doubled up on housing. They put their stuff in storage. Basically, the pandemic created a unique demand driver that drove that vacancy rate down to a record low level in 2021, and it outperformed. Since then, the market's normalized a little bit. The vacancy rates are tracking back upwards, 9.3% in our most recent number, which is still first quarter. We don't have the second quarter data on self-storage yet for vacancy rates. But the concern I have is that there is a new wave of construction coming online. We're starting to see a little bit in 23, but I think the bulk of it's going to start showing up in 2024 and going into 2025. So I don't think it's going to get to the same level we were at in 2019, but it is going to have an impact on the market. So again, self-storage investment, you have to pay attention to the development pipeline in the vicinity of your asset. You need to really keep an eye on that. Nobody wants to get into a property and have, you know, other new properties going into lease up right next door or across the street. It creates some big challenges for operations. So definitely keep an eye on the construction pipeline for self-storage. We do expect vacancies to be on the rise this year and going into next year. The demand drivers are still sound. The millennial generation is a heavy user of self-storage, and the metrics and the demographics look good. I am a little concerned about what's happening with supply on a localized basis. Very briefly on hotels, they were absolutely crushed by the pandemic. When you look at where they are today, they've basically fully recovered. So you had occupancy rates in the 64-65% range before the pandemic, record high. They fell into the mid 40% range, which is a record low in a matter of months. It took a while to recover. Today, they're at about 63.5%, but they are being purposely held down. The occupancy rates are lower than they were before the pandemic because of the labor shortage. Basically, hotel operators don't have enough labor, so they're holding some of their rooms out of inventory. They're not leasing them out. That occupancy rate is a little bit lower as a result. But when you look at the average daily rate, it is through the roof. Anybody who's going out and staying in a hotel right now knows that those hotel rates are just astronomical compared to their historical norm. Part of that, of course, is inflation, but part of it is that occupancies are at a record level based on what the operators can use because of that labor shortage. So that's a key factor there. Hotels are operating very well right now, and the momentum is strong. But again, as that savings burns off, the consumption and the spending on hotels is expected to come down. Just to put some things in perspective, looking at revenue growth, net operating incomes, industrial way out ahead, 42% growth since 2019, suburban apartments up 22%, and you work your way all the way down to the downtown offices, negative 11% revenue compared to 2019. I will note here, suburban office still keeping its nose above the water, 0.7% growth on suburban office. So huge range, but overall, commercial real estate has done very well over the last few years. Really strong income growth, which then drives the yield on these assets. So for my last section, I got a few slides on what's happening with the sales market, and then we'll get into a conversation here. But basically, here's a chart that shows you just how crazy the market's been. The fourth quarter of 2021 more transactions than any quarter in the history of the industry. Almost 20,000 transactions closed in the fourth quarter of 2021, and that's priced $2.5 million and greater. You look at the momentum from there, it kind of moved back into a more normal trend in 2022. But in 2023, we've seen a huge fall off. That's tied to what's happening with the interest rates and the disconnect between buyers and sellers, and just generally the lack of debt capital that's out there. It's really slowed the market way down. We're basically, you know, kind of just north of where we were at the beginning of the pandemic in terms of our transaction counts in the first and second quarters of 2023. Looking at the activity from our firm, the broker opinions of value, the buyers putting letters of intent, the activity on our website, we see this momentum building. I think third quarter is going to see a little bit of a pickup, but it will take time to prime that pump, and fourth quarter will be a little bit better still. We're probably looking at moving back into a more normal range, even with the higher interest rates. I don't expect the interest rates to come down substantively, but as the market adapts and as people need to transact, we'll move back into something like, you know, a 2014, 15, 16 type transaction activity levels as we go forward. You look at pricing, it's come down quite a bit, you know, multifamily down about 13% compared to last year. You know, you look at office, a 20% reduction, retail down about 15%, and so on, industrial down 5% and 9% reduction in values for self-storage. These are estimates. It's really hard to pin down pricing right now. To get these numbers, I went in and looked at all of our pending transactions that we have in the pipeline right now to get a rough estimate, just based on where we see the strike prices compared to where they were a year ago. But we are seeing a little bit of a correction. Now, I have to point out, when you compare values today to where they were at the end of 2019 before the pandemic, huge growth. Self-storage up almost 40%. In terms of its pricing, industrial 25%, hospitality 20%, multifamily up 17%. Retail's down a little bit, basically flat, and office is down about 15% from where we were before the pandemic. So yes, there's a correction going on, but we're giving up some of the growth, the explosive growth, quite frankly, that we had last year and the year before, and not all of it, just a small portion of it, actually. So we are seeing a little bit of a correction happening in the marketplace today because of what's happening with the lending climate and with interest rates. When you look at the cap rates, we do see a little bit of a bounce there up, you know, to 5.5% for apartments. And I gave the cap rates for the different property types earlier, but basically I just want you to see the trend. They are all navigating up, over the course of the last year or so as the market's been grappling with the change in the cost of capital. So, that's what we're seeing there. I do expect this to stabilize over the next 6 to 9 months. The reason being, that the market is going through a recalibration process, and we're pretty close to getting through that. Now, assuming the Fed doesn't raise rates going forward, we should be able to see these things stabilize. Why go into real estate now? There's a large volume of real estate that faces a loan maturity in 2023 and 2024. That will fuel the available assets for sale, and that's going to be a real factor going forward. A lot of people have been holding out for this huge level of delinquency and distress. It is not coming. You look at the distress levels, the delinquency rates on loans, we're talking about 4 or 5%. You know, office is one of the most significantly impacted property sector. You read about it in the news, people giving back keys, people going under, and all these things. But those are isolated stories. That's not the market as a whole. Compared to the financial crisis, when we were at 10, 11% distress level, we're less than half of that. We're actually about a third of that level right now. And I don't expect it to rise that much. So if you're looking at investing, it's not going to get a lot better. is my point. You're not going to see this huge wave of distress coming out on the market and all these great deals unless you're looking to buy an office. Office will have some. There are some deals out there already. But again, like I said earlier, that is not for the faint of heart. And then, just to wrap up here, the spread between cap rates and the 10-year treasury had collapsed. It was down to about 200 basis points as we went through into the fourth quarter of 2021, when we had all those transactions coming through the market. The cost of capital, though, you can get a loan for 3.5%. You can't today. Now it's 5%, 6%, 7%. And so those cap rates are coming up, but the 10-year treasury is pretty stable right now, and right around 4%. And that spread has widened out. We're not going to get to 400 or 500 basis point spreads anytime soon. Don't wait for that. But that spread has opened up, and it is creating a little bit of opportunity out there. So, gentlemen, that's my big, long presentation. I hope there's some value in there.
John, that was incredible.
Thank you, John. Tate's dying to ask a question. Tate, jump in.
Yeah, so I have a question for you. You kind of touched on it there. You know, for our audience that may not be as familiar with how commercial real estate loans work, could you just talk briefly about sort of why the super fast rise in interest rates has put sort of a stressor on commercial real estate with these loan maturities? And like you said, it's not affecting a huge portion of properties, but why we might be seeing commercial real estate sort of in certain pockets in trouble because of that.
Sure. You know, so when people think about mortgages, they usually think of their home mortgage, right? Which you can go and, you know, everybody got a loan at whatever, 3% interest rate. They lock it for 30 years and they're dialed in and ready to go. For commercial real estate, first of all, you can't lock for 30 years. Your rate, you may get a term of 7 years fixed or 5 year fixed. But a lot of investors were using adjustable rate mortgages because the rates had been so low. The other thing is that when you're buying a residential property, you go in and you can lock your rate for 30, 60, 90 days while you close the transaction. A lot of the times commercial real estate, you can't do that. So you go in, you underwrite a deal based on where the rates are today. So when the rates were rising so quickly, even if you were going to use fixed rate financing, between when you wrote the deal and when you got to the closing table, that interest rate may have moved 100, 150 basis points, maybe even more than that, maybe 200 basis points. And that really throws off your underwriting. You're planning on a fixed rate on your cost of capital, and that capital changes by 100 basis points. It really impacts how much cash flow you're able to generate with that asset going forward. So that's a big problem. The other big problem was, again, a lot of investors have been using variable rate financing. They did not lock in a rate. And in some cases, they didn't even put a cap on it. You can buy like almost like an insurance against your interest rate to lock it in so it doesn't rise more than whatever 30 basis points, 50, 100 basis points, whatever you choose. And basically, you can purchase an extra cap on that. A lot of investors didn't do that either. So when those rates shot upward, those adjustable rate mortgages went up with it, and it basically eroded all of the cash flow out of those properties. And in many cases, those investors are now having to pour additional capital into those properties. For limited partners, they may get cash calls where they have to go in, and rather than, you know, earning income on a property as they had planned, now they're having to feed the beast and send money to that investor in order to cover the cash flow, going upside down on the cash flow on those properties. So it created a lot of problems in the marketplace. And basically, when the transaction was happening, the buyer comes in, they says, okay, I'll pay you $10 million. The seller says, great, I want $10 million. And then as they get to the closing table, the buyer says, look, my cost of capital went up so much, I'm only going to pay you $9 million. And the seller says, hey, wait a second, I thought we said 10. The buyer says, no way, that's not happening. One of the other things that's happened recently, and this is actually a major issue, is that we have banks pulling out of lending commitments right up to the last minute. I've heard about deals where that they're at the closing, they're going to the closing. Now, you know, they may be closing in 2 days, and the bank calls up and goes, yeah, you know, that loan we told you we had for you, yeah, we're not going to do it. And it's really creating some chaos in the transaction market. One of the things I've been recommending is that when buyers go out to buy a property and they get lending commitments, I recommend you work with a mortgage broker. Even if you have a fantastic relationship with your bank, get a mortgage broker involved. They have relationships with hundreds of different banks. And I know in talking to ours at Marcus Millichap Capital Corp, what they're doing is they're actually lining up two or three lenders on a deal, so that if one pulls out, they have another one they can plug in right away. And so they have backup strategies right now because the lending climate is so choppy, and it's really can lead to some prices that people really just don't want in a commercial real estate transaction.
So interesting. Ryan.
All right. You have $100,000 and you're an LP and you got to invest today.
I just give you guys all my money. Isn't that the right answer?
you got a 5-year hold, $100,000. You got to place it today. Gun to your head. Where are you putting it? What asset class? What market? What are you doing?
So for me personally, the answers are different, right? Because I spend every waking moment looking at real estate. I look at economy and I'm looking at local economics. I have a team of 20 people outside this door who help me understand the markets, right? So I have access to essentially all of the information on commercial real estate, which is why I only invest in real estate, right? If you know, invest where you know. So yeah. When I'm looking at it, I'm going to look at market nuances, things that are happening in a local market that are not readily apparent, that are going to change structurally from what people are expecting. So I'm going to look at a major manufacturing plant that may be going in that not everybody knows about and that's going to create a lot of jobs. For example, here in Phoenix where I am, you have Taiwan Semiconductor coming in, building out a huge plant. It's going to have 20,000 jobs in phase one, and there's 6 phases. So you go out and you look at that. Now, there's no inventory around there and builders are trying to get in there, but that is an opportunity. If you look at San Antonio apartments, one of the highest vacancy rates of any of the metros in the country, but we also know supply chains are being shortened. There's a reshoring process and a nearshoring process that's moving manufacturing from China to Mexico. I was down in Mexico a month ago and talking to some people down there. And the manufacturing basis in those areas that are across the border from San Antonio are growing like crazy. They can't keep up with it. And San Antonio is going to be the beneficiary of that. So you look at housing. You look at what's happening with office. There are properties that are being sold at a significant discount. Now, I'm not going to go and invest in office because I don't know office as well as I know a lot of other property types, and there's a lot of nuances there, but there are opportunities. When I talk to office investors, they see some opportunities coming out where there's blood in the streets, if you will, and they are in a position to capitalize on those. You know, if I'm looking at, you know, I'm getting older, right? And I'm thinking long term, I may want to put it into something like a medical office building. I like those dynamics over a 10-year horizon. I think medical office is a great place to be. Self-storage. I like self-storage, except you better put it with someone who knows the business. They have to know the local market. They have to know that construction pipeline. Don't just put that money with anybody. Make sure that the people you're investing with know the market. Only, and this is true pretty much with every property type. If I'm an LP, I'm going to go research the management of the firm I'm going to invest in. I want to know that they're an expert and they have access to other experts and they have those relationships, because this is going to get a little tricky over the next 5 years. The last 5 years, come on, you can forecast with a ruler. You drop it on the table and it's all going up. It's been good, right? They've been the best of times. Yeah. Looking forward, we got financing issues. We got economic issues. We have the Federal Reserve that's being very active. There are a lot of economic drivers that are in play. and local market drivers that are in play that are going to affect those assets. And you better make sure that whoever you're putting your capital with, that they understand that property type and those markets that they're going to be investing in.
Such a good answer.
All right. What are you most bearish on other than office?
Oh, sure. Take the easy one away.
We already know that. We already know that no one's doing office. Or you, like you said, sophisticated people are doing office that know what they're doing and have the cash.
You know, I'm not going to characterize it with any one property type, right? So there are markets that have huge waves of construction. And I think that people got out over their skis. You look at, say, industrial, one of the most popular asset classes out there, one of the most favorite asset classes. There are companies that are just crushing it in industrial. But if you are in the wrong building and you are in the wrong location and there's 40 million square feet popping up next door, you got a problem. So yeah. I'm concerned about some of the high construction markets. The same is true with multifamily, quite frankly. If you are investing in multifamily and there is a huge pile of new development in the immediate vicinity and you don't have a strong demand driver that's being created simultaneously, you can get in trouble with that. Retail. I'm actually feeling pretty good about retail. I think retail, there's no new construction out there. It's going to coast it out. The retail sales are flattening out, but that sector's it's reinvented itself over the last 20 years and it's in a pretty good place right now. I think it's segmentation, right? It's not any one asset class. It's not any one market. Downtown San Francisco, probably not at the top of my list right now. It's really having a tough time. Highest vacancy rates about every property type out there. It will reinvent itself. There is a lot of AI development going on in that space. There's a lot of tech there. But downtown San Francisco is going to have to reinvent itself, and that's going to take time.
Love it. Well, John, I can't tell you how much we appreciate having you on. We're over on time. I want to be respectful of yours. Thank you so much for coming on, and we look forward to talking with you in the future.
Thanks, John.
Thank you.
Thank you. Take care.